Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer. I'm your host, Sarah Bueno. I'm a psychotherapist, teacher, consultant, and most importantly, a wounded healer, living and working in Chicago, Illinois.
And I'm your host, Anne Remy. I'm a counseling psychotherapist, yoga teacher, and trauma specialist living in Brighton, UK. On this show, we interview folks in a variety of healing professions, and we discuss the intersectional journey of healing self while caring for others.
But we're not just focused on individual healing, but also healing on the collective level, from white supremacy, late-stage capitalism, and the patriarchy. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Anne.
How you doing?
I'm good.
I'm great.
How are you?
Having a good day.
That's excellent. The sun has been shining in Chicago, and in the winter, that is not something we can count on, so it's made me a lot happier this winter.
I have been able to leave my house in a sweater in England, which I can't even do in the summer half the time, so I don't know what's going on.
Winning!
Probably not great for the planet, to be honest, but you know what? It's happening right now, so I'm going to be happy that I can be outside in a sweater.
I dig.
Yeah. Hey, if you like being outside in a sweater, why don't you purchase a hoodie?
Damn, you're good.
I know. It's all those years as a salesperson. You can purchase hoodies or really anything from our merch store at tinyurl.com/CWHmerch. And you can rate and review us on Apple Podcast. And if you do that, between today, this very day you're listening, if you're listening to it on the release date, and April 24th, and then you screenshot your review and you send it to Sarah, you're going to be entered into a drawing to win an hour session with both Sarah and I. I am offering...
So 2 hours.
2 hours at the same time. So we're both just going to be talking over each other for... Can you imagine the chaos? Right. I am offering a yoga session or support in planning travel, specifically for people who struggle with solo travel. Sarah, what are you offering?
I am going to be offering a choice between a Reiki session or a business consultation session.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And we're doing this because it's my anniversary on the podcast in May. So we're celebrating that. So go on over and rate and review us for your chance to win some cool stuff with us.
Yeah. And I understand that this is discriminatory against Android users. So I'm hoping that you have access to some sort of Mac computer if you don't have an iPhone so that you can also participate in this. So I apologize that this is discriminatory against Android users. I'm so sorry that Spotify and other places haven't figured out places to rate and review in an accurate way. So I apologize for that.
We're just living in Steve Jobs' world.
Yep. True.
The last thing you can do to support us is to go to patreon.com/convoswithawoundedhealer. And you can support us on Patreon, which gives you access to all kinds of cool conversations that Sarah and I are having not on the regular podcast, including an EMDR session and our thoughts on a lot of other things that we don't get the chance to talk about too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. And you can give as little as $1 a month. I think these conversations are at the $7 level. But if you give us anything, we will send you a little welcome gift if you're in the US or UK. So thank you.
And we'll just shout out to my mom who subscribed.
Yes, yes. I was like, this name seems familiar. And I sent it to Anne and I was like, are you related to this person?
Yep.
She's
thanks,
like,
mom.
That's my mom. So thanks, mom.
Thanks, mom.
Every little bit helps. I'll adopt you because
thanks
my mother is dead and I didn't have a good relationship with her. So I'll take you.
She'll probably take that adoption. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I have a feeling. We've never met, but I have a feeling we're going to like each other.
Oh yeah. 100%. So Eugene Ellis, Sarah, what did you think about this conversation?
I really enjoyed it. And the thing that struck me first was his experience of going to a white therapist to begin to work through his own racial identity. And that, I mean, we just released the episode with Shelley Touchluck where it talks about, you know, white people needing to do this work, specifically white therapists. And mm-hmm. I think Eugene is a perfect example of why that's so crucial. And, you know, I'll just share a little bit of my own experience being a white therapist who has worked with people of color. And I've been in that position that his therapist was in, sort of seeing something that maybe my client wasn't naming in terms mm-hmm. of a potential racist incident, or maybe something that they were internalizing racism. And I'm so glad that I had that lens. And, you know, of course, I'm never pushing something on somebody, but I've brought it up in ways saying like, yeah, I hear what you're saying, that this could be this person being a jerk. I'm also holding that it could be racism. Mm. And, you know, I don't want to say too specific of things, but one of my clients definitely like ran with that and began to deepen her journey of knowing herself as a person in a body of culture, as Resmaa mm-hmm. Menakem would say. And it was really, really cool. And I wasn't guiding her mm-hmm. on that part of her journey, but I was, because I knew enough, I was able to be a cheerleader yeah. for her and, you know, give her suggestions of people to follow and this and that. And it was really, it was cool.
Mm. I agree with you 100% that, you know, his story is the perfect example of all the potential that we hold as white therapists to be active agents of yeah. support, which also shows the potential to be active agents of hurt. And it's such a powerful position that we're in as therapists.
Yes. Yes.
And just really like taking that with the full credence that it deserves, maybe?
Like gravity?
Gravity, yeah. Thank you. That's a better word for it.
Yeah. I mean, I could go down a rabbit hole of how much we have to reconcile with our relationship to how much power we hold. But yeah, I mean, the other thing that I thought was interesting in your conversation that is like, we're not in the colorblind era where we're like, we're all equal. And yet we still have to find ways that we're connecting to each other's humanity. And I mm-hmm. loved that you were impacted by his book, not as a person of color, but as an expat in the UK, when you're like, wait a minute, why are you guys not talking about this weird shit you're doing? Mm-hmm. And then Eugene mentions it in the book. So I thought that was really cool, too, that there was that connection that he didn't intend when he wrote the book, but you were able to pick that up and feel that kinship.
Well, his book was really grounding to me in a lot of ways as somebody who came into the UK and was like, Like, why is this? And I have said so many times, for all the countries I've been to, this has been the most difficult one to be in, as far as like to be myself in, or to like understand the cultures around me, because we speak the same language, but we don't speak the same language at all.
I've never heard you say it that plainly. That's profound.
It's very real. You know, I think that my experience in the UK is one of just constant, like, to use the therapeutic term, like, I'm just consistently attempting to attune to what is going on around me. And because of the sort of ingrained cultural communication style here, which is one of like holding back, or a lot of like passive aggressive comments, or like you're meant to read into a lot of the subtext, it is so difficult. And I can't imagine doing it if English was your second language, because it's hard as hell to do it when it's my first. And so reading Eugene's book was like, oh my God, I'm not the only person seeing this, which is actually, I'm going to be honest, helped me work, because I work a lot with clients who are not from the UK. And they all say the same things, which is just, it just reinforces my experience. But I'm like, there is a collective experience of struggling to assimilate no matter where you're from. And I even hear it within British people, to be honest, this like calling out for, there's a lot of stuff in this culture that makes it really difficult to be here and makes it very difficult to be British. And, you know, I think his book does a great job of talking about that from the Black British experience and the history that comes with that, and the current experiences of that. And it also, I'm going to recommend his book to anybody who wants to learn more about colonialism, because that book taught me more about colonialism than living in the UK or anything else.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's not even, it wasn't even like his number one intention,
right.
You know, like, but that's right. Just how little people learn about colonialism here and how little it is spoken about. And you said, we don't live in this. Mm-hmm. I don't see color world anymore, but there is a lot of that here still.
Yeah.
So I think resources like Eugene's book are very necessary, and his message, his work is very necessary for all of us. But I think even it would be a great general education book, to be honest.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, if people weren't banning all the books in the U.S., yeah.
Well, do you know what? They don't teach colonialism in schools here.
I mean, not shocking.
It's the same thing. So, you know, I think it should be required reading for a lot of people in school. But unfortunately, you would first have to explain what colonialism is, I think, mm-hmm. to a lot of people. So, but for people who are starting to like do this work, it's a very embodied resource. It helps you kind of understand your place in this and your feelings as you're going through it. Really, really helpful. And I think that that comes through, hopefully, in this interview. I think you can hear it in Eugene and the way that he speaks and the way that he talks about his experience and kind of what he's working towards. So with that, may I introduce him?
Please.
Yay. Eugene Ellis is a psychotherapist, writer, and public speaker on issues of race, difference, and intersectionality. For the past 20 years, Eugene has been the director and founder of the Black African and Asian Therapy Network, also known as the BATN Network, the UK's largest independent organization to specialize in working therapeutically with Black African, Caribbean, and South Asian people. So please enjoy this conversation with Eugene Ellis.
Wonderful.
Huzzah.
Hey there, therapist. How you doing? If you're like a lot of people out there, maybe you need a little bit more support than usual. Well, I've got you covered. I'm currently running two groups that I plan to run again in the fall of 2024. So add your name to the wait list to be notified as soon as info is available. First is the Burnt Out Practice Owner Support Group for group therapy practice owners. We'll focus on the emotional component of business ownership while building trust and connection with other practice owners. We'll explore topics such as boundary setting, feeling underappreciated, overwork, and find ways to reconnect with our agency. And you'll also have the support of other practice owners when challenges arise within your business. Next is the Authentic Leaders Group. It's here to help you become the authentic and wholehearted leader you aspire to be. Join me on an 8-month journey of self-discovery and leadership mastery, where you'll enhance your leadership skills and forge meaningful connections with fellow therapists who are committed to their own growth and the betterment of the therapy field. For the Burnt Out Practice Owner waitlist, go to www.headheartbiztherapy.com/burntout. Make sure you've got the T in B-U-R-N-T-O-U-T. And next is the Authentic Leaders Group waitlist at www.headheartbiztherapy.com/authentic-leaders-group. Hope to see you soon.
Eugene, welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Anne.
I'm excited to talk to you. And for our listeners, if you remember our episode with Aisha Mackenzie Mavinga, back when I first started hosting, Aisha is how I learned about Eugene and his work. So if you haven't listened to that episode, I'm sure it'll be a good companion to this. But Eugene, could you introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, my name's Eugene Ellis. I'm a psychotherapist. I work in adoption mainly and around the area of trauma. I also founded an organization 20 years ago called the Black African and Asian Therapy Network. And we can talk more about that, I guess, this podcast. But it's mainly a sort of membership organization or collective of therapists from those heritages coming together to sort of commune with one another, to sort of seek refuge, to talk about the difficulties in the profession. And to hopefully give a bit of a window, you know, I think the idea when I started it was a bit of a window for, you know, just the general public to kind of have a look and look through this portal and kind of see all this activity going on, you know, with sort of racialized people in the UK. So it's very UK focused. And I'm also an author as well. So I wrote a book in 21 called The Race Conversation.
In that book, I highly recommend, whether you're a therapist in the UK or in the US, or even if you're not a therapist, actually, I learned more about colonialism from your book than I have from 6 years living in the UK, which says a lot about the state of the way they talk about colonialism in the UK.
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, the book is coming out in the US.
Ah, score!
Next year. So
great.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that sort of coming out there. changing publishers now to the American publishers. So yeah, we'll see how it goes there. And I think a lot of Americans are seeing that sort of colonial history, maybe fresh, maybe new ways,
yeah.
And how important it is really also for the US,
yeah.
You know, because actually that's, you know, that history brings the US into being,
yeah,
really,
yeah.
So yeah, yeah. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm excited that people in the States will be able to access it. It really is, in my school papers, one of my most referenced books.
Oh, yeah. That's great. So, oh, I love that.
It's been incredibly helpful to me. I've done a lot of work on the sort of lack of education around this in the therapy trainings and in the therapy space. So yeah, I'm really curious, and this is me, you know, doing my training now in modern life, and we're still not really getting what I would say anywhere close to adequate training on how difference of any type shows up in the therapy space. And I'm really curious if you see, or I guess through your career, what differences you have and haven't seen through that time.
It comes in waves, doesn't it? I think. I mean, I've seen, you know, race and difference and oppression as trauma. And that's the way I sort of think about it. And healing trauma is never really a kind of straight line curve, is it, going up?
Mm-hmm.
It's always circles. And sometimes the circles go down and sometimes the circle go up.
Yeah.
Each time, you know, there's something happens in the zeitgeist, you know, George Floyd or a march or something happens to sort of galvanize people. And then there's a kind of a, everyone sort of orientates towards, you know, what could be done. And then over time, you know, that orientation sort of drifts onto something else. And then a new thing happens. But I think certainly since COVID, certainly in the UK at least, and since the murder of George Floyd, there has been, you know, upward interest in this. I mean, the way I'm thinking about this at the moment is, of course, there's going to be some changes as time goes on in terms of, you know, oppression being attended to in society in general. And if we're talking about a therapy profession, perhaps starting there as well. But also, you know, there is a kind of a mechanism which, you know, one could call late stage capitalism or just capitalism in general, that kind of creates the conditions where it's almost a sort of function of the system to have oppression.
Yeah.
So there's these two forces, feudal force, if you want to call it that, where all the resources kind of trickle all to the top, or a sort of more democratic force where things, you know, where actually resources start to go down to the general masses. So I think there's always those forces going on. And over time, you know, that kind of formula, sort of that balance changes. I think overall, though, although it's very slow, it does feel like there's a move towards healing generally. It's very hard to see that hope and despair cycle is still runs wild in me. You know, sometimes I get a little flavor of hope, only to have this massive despair when things are not turning out as I thought they might.
Yeah.
So I think generally overall feels like there's a shift, but it's glacial, isn't it? Feels very glacial.
Yeah, and I feel it's disheartening to hear you say that as somebody who's been in the industry so much longer, and as well as a Black man who does experience the effects of all of these, you know, systems of oppression. It's disappointing to hear that you don't see the changes moving as quickly, or I guess the answer that one would hope for is, oh, it's changed so much since I started, you know, my career or throughout my life. And I think it speaks exactly to what you said, this idea of how much oppression is tied up in our way of being in the sort of capitalist society, but also just in the culture, this idea of I can't succeed unless somebody else is pushed down.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is what really underpins a lot of this work, isn't it? That feeling that you just kind of talked about, should I even do anything if that's the case? You know, if things aren't changing, why even do anything? So that's always a tension, isn't it? And trying to find hope or a little grain of something that you can kind of hang on to. Continue doing the work is a big challenge, isn't it?
Yeah. Where do you find your hope?
I get kind of inspired by people of all heritages, actually, because my first therapeutic kind of encounter, you know, I was in the music business, a music industry. So I was a sound engineer. So I was doing quite a lot of work, quite successful, some people might say. But, you know, they looked at me. But you know how it is. Sometimes you can have success, maybe financial or some other kind of success. And, you know, in your heart, you're feeling it to some level, but your life isn't really that great. You know, I didn't feel very connected to people in the world. I mean, there are good reasons for that. And I kind of looked in, I'm sure it's still out, called Time Out magazine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And this is like a London magazine. It shows you all of the things going on in London, the theatres and all that kind of stuff. And it has a section on therapist. So I just looked in there. I found a therapist. And I don't know why, actually, what prompted me to do that. I just felt like something needed to change. And it just kind of crept up on me. I didn't really, it wasn't kind of like, nothing really happened. You know, nothing big happened. Mm. It was just a slow kind of maybe a sense of closing down, perhaps even really, and then watching everyone else get on with their lives, seemingly untroubled, and I was just feeling all of this stuff. So I found a therapist, and then that led me to actually where you trained, a place called Metanoia, and I did a group there with one of the founders, who was a South African woman who came over in the 80s and founded this organization, Metanoia, and it was a sort of radical sort of therapy place. So my introduction to therapy was this woman, and I hadn't read. I mean, of course, I'd listened to lots of stuff about on the radio about Black history, but I hadn't really, really taken on board what it was like to be a Black man living in the UK. And really, of course, I thought about it. Other people were talking about it, but I hadn't really thought about it in relation to me. And I think there's a lot of people who haven't. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a thing out there. Yeah. And people will talk about it, but then when it comes closer to their own hearts, it gets more challenging.
Yeah.
And so she challenged me in good, positive ways to reflect on that. So in some ways, it felt like she was a few steps ahead of me in terms of Black consciousness than me.
I'm actually like blown away by this, that because she was a white woman, that especially in the 80s, 90s, that she was kind of challenging you to explore this identity and your experience of it, and especially kind of knowing the same training institute now kind of makes it even more surprising. But I'm quite shocked to hear that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like you need to. It was kind of things like I'd be talking about myself, and she would say, "Oh, you know, have you considered? You know, you're a black man living in London. Have you considered that part of the mix of your experience?" So it's just you know, just throwing in things like that, and it's like, "Oh no, well yes and no." I mean, I hadn't really, you know, dug in deep, and of course that was a big part of my experience, and certainly my family's history. You know, seeped in the Caribbean, which has its own history, you know, and over time, I began to realize that actually a lot of that history, it's mainly the history, actually, that's kind of brought me to this mind that I had, sort of disconnected mind, and a sort of unrelational mind, that sort of like, I would just sort of pull back in terms of connection. So that was my experience. I mean, if you want to put a label on it. But that's kind of how I experienced it. And then over time, I've just been making more and more connections with people and the world and ideas. And that's kind of been my journey, really. Sort of leading up to this, to Barton, which is like a huge connection for therapists, to some extent have, you know, a similar experience of being a racialized therapist in a sort of therapy profession that on the whole doesn't feel that impacts on people's mental health, you know, just that fact. They want to go back to the family, to the early attachments. Yeah, that's great. But there's also an attachment or lack of attachment for some people to society itself and the way the society, you know, that the gaze of society as opposed to the gaze of the mother or the father, you know. So throwing all of those into the mix, you know, really important for me.
And I love I don't know that I've heard about the male gaze and the white gaze, but the concept of the gaze of society, it makes perfect sense because that impacts so much the way that we will see ourselves as a whole, not just as sort of individual identities. meaning, you know, like the male gaze makes me hyper-conscious of what about me as a woman is right or wrong or safe or not safe. I'm guessing the white gaze would do the same for people of color. But the societal gaze is really interesting because that's almost intersectional. It kind of tackles all of those things at the same time.
Mm. Yes, yes. And it's nonverbal. It's very nonverbal, isn't it? And that's kind of where my book sort of centers. I know it's called The Race Conversation, but it's sort of focused on the nonverbal side of things. And the gaze is so powerful, isn't it? Just the human gaze, one gaze upon another, you know, just how you look. You know, how my dad would look at me and didn't need to say anything.
Oh,
or anyone can look, or a teacher looks at you. And they don't have to say anything, do they? You just know, you know, when you shrink under the gaze or you flower under the gaze, don't you? Those are the sort of,
And that's, I think, one of the things I found so helpful about your book is how it does incorporate. So I'm really body-based and using kind of my felt sense and my whole somatic experience. So your book really, I think, did exactly what you just did, is you know what a gaze feels like. You can't always describe it, but you know the feeling of fear when your parent looks at you with the look, right? And even though the way that feeling is internalized might feel different between me and you, we both know what the look means, and we both know exactly what that would elicit in the other emotionally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think sometimes this is where I find hope, is in these moments, these small moments of connection where, okay, you and I were raised in two different countries. We have completely different identities, very different sets of experiences, but we can find commonality in that.
Yes.
And that's where I find hope, because I feel like finding these small pieces of relatability can be huge. That is a safe place to start a conversation from. It's a safe place to start a relationship from. Yeah. And from there, so much can open up.
Yeah, that's so necessary, isn't it? I mean, because I started off in that group, and obviously this person was doing the work that I thought was, you know, the therapy profession. That's what I thought therapy was, you know, and of course it is. And then I thought, wow, this is great. I'm going to train as a therapist. It wasn't quite that, but that's how I got there in the end. Then when I got to the training, I thought, oh, what's this? This isn't the same stuff that I was doing before.
Oh, interesting.
This is a whole different thing. And then I realized that what I was doing before, and I was in the group for a while, 4 years or so, was radical in the wider kind of profession. And so having these conversations around race, having these conversations around difference, diversity, and it just didn't seem like it was even attended to. And people said, oh, you know, maybe it's the theories that they're using, that are Eurocentric theories. And so, well, yeah, but, you know, Eurocentric theory, I mean, all theories are trying to get to a place where humans can communicate better with themselves or with each other. I mean, that's the sort of whole idea, isn't it? So there's these kind of theories. So they're all going in the right direction. They're all going in the same direction. But just for some reason, the color was just taken out. I just really hadn't really considered the social impact on people's lives, how we construct ourselves socially and our identities. And that was just so missing, you know, it was so obvious, but I was so kind of dumbstruck. The first 2 years, I didn't quite know what to do about it.
Yeah, it has to have been jarring to go from your first experience with therapy being part of what kind of helped you start looking at race and your identity, and then to go into training where that was largely ignored.
Yeah. I mean, I came in with a lot of hope. And I think a lot of therapists do, or, you know, trainees come in a way, you know, this is a therapy profession. They're supposed to, that's their job, isn't it? To attend to hurts. That's the whole game, isn't it? To sit with it, transform it, find a way through, make connection. And yes, I mean, that is what they were doing. But when it came to any kind of intersection of identity, race or gender or anything like that, there was just this silence. And so I can remember many occasions trying to sort of bring some of that stuff in, and people were just really struggling with how to respond. They knew that I was wounded somewhere. And if I had expressed a different wound, maybe a wound about, you know, I don't know, some sort of parent injury, or something, I imagine that they'd be able to respond much easier, yeah. or they kind of have a template of what to do and what to say. But it was almost like there was no template about what to even, how to even start. So I'll just keep quiet then, because I, you know, and then there's just this tumbleweeds moments throughout the training of silence. It's like, whoa, okay, this is amazing.
It really speaks to how adaptable we're not as a profession. Yeah. If, you know, I can't imagine, I'm sure there are situations, right? Because we've all got our blind spots, but I cannot imagine having a client come to me asking me to consider something or telling me that they want to talk about something and then me going, that's not really relevant. Yeah. So it kind of speaks to this, like how hard it is to turn a large ship, but also speaks to how much society and trainings don't support the teachers to encourage these types of, just reflections.
Yeah, I think, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, the group of students and they're sort of, you know, everyone turns to the facilitator, you know, the person doing the teaching for some wisdom and some guidance in this moment of difficulty. And, you know, and they're also equally stumped as the students are. I think that, I mean, in a way, trainings reflect normal life. Mm-hmm. And my initial therapy was rare. My therapist sort of came from a particular context in South Africa where black and white is like, it's like, you know, it's like, it was so stark.
Yeah.
She had to get away. And so, you know, she was coming from that particular context. But more than that, she was willing to sort of dive in there as well, you know, and somehow she'd kind of made some kind of sense of all of that. So in a way, I had a sort of rarefied experience, I think. Perhaps a rare experience. So that's what I sort of came to find out. But then afterwards, I have met many other people, different racialized identities who, you know, the work that they've been doing on them, you know, in the world generally and on themselves has given me hope. You know, those are the things when I see someone transcending, or not transcending, but sort of moving beyond the sort of limits of the racial construct that they've been assigned, and they're sort of digging into the areas that they're not really supposed to get into. And then that being a sort of healing, there's a sort of healing aspect to that. So that gave me a lot of hope, you know, when I see that. And I do see it often. Certainly the people I speak to, most people I speak to, are working in that area. So I get to meet more and more people as time goes on. So there is that. That's where I get my hope, in those moments.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's a reparative experience for you as you start to meet more of these people.
Yeah. It sort of counters the despair or that kind of, you know, where you sort of can't even envisage doing anything because, you know, all avenues seem to be blocked. And, you know, if you do this, there's always a, you know, if you step out the boundaries of the race construct, you know, there's always a sort of a payment that gets exacted from you somehow, somewhere. And that's quite, takes a big toll on the body, I think, coming back to the body, you know, this work, isn't it? It's a massive toll on the body. And then there's these kind of moments where you see something, you might read a book, or someone has rethought of their position in a particular way, which has kind of just edged them along a particular path which they're interested in going in. They just sort of add a nice soothing balm to that feeling of, oh God, the hopelessness, you know, which is such a feature of this, isn't it? Yeah, it sort of keeps me carrying on.
Yeah. And I wonder what it's like for you to be able to be that balm to others.
I'm taking it in more. I've been told that. I've been told that, yeah, and I've read the book, or I've heard a talk, or this is that and that. And it's, wow, it's really kind of, you know, I can feel the balm, you know, sort of seeping in through the pores as they speak to me. And I'm part of me thinking, oh, it's not me. You know, I'm just, you know, I'm just a vessel, you know.
No.
I guess that's just my pattern of kind downplaying what I do. But I think I'm learning to be proud of yourself. You know, there's something wrong with that. So I think there's something in me that sort of counters that. I always want to sort of downplay it. But I've been told that I need to take it in. And I'm trying. That's all I can say. But I do experience that, though. I do experience me being this sort of healing balm on some levels to other people.
I really heard the British cultural gaze in this. don't be too proud of yourself.
Yeah, British Caribbean as well. It's that Britishness has sort of seeped into Jamaica, where my parents are. You can't be too full of yourself, you know. And I think there's a British angle to that, but also in the sort of colonial period as well. There's also, you know, to be too full of yourself is dangerous. So I think there's something also there as well. But no, it's definitely there.
That's so interesting. I never thought about that. I always think of it as something that's a white British way of being that's kind of seeped into everyone else. But when you say under colonial rule, it wasn't safe to be too visible, too proud of yourself, too seen, too anything. That's such a good point.
Yeah, so it layers on top of the, you know, the normal British way as well. You know, so it's another extra layer of stuff, you know. But I'm kind of learning to take those comments from people.
Do you know what's just around the corner? It's Anne's anniversary being part of Conversations with a Wounded Healer. And we are celebrating the anniversary with a giveaway for anybody who wants to write an Apple Podcast review between March 6th and April 24th of 2024. So go to Apple Podcast, whether it's on your phone or your laptop, search for Conversations with a Wounded Healer. Click on the show and scroll down until you see ratings and reviews. Tap write a review and tell us what you think about the show. Then you'll screenshot your review and email it to me at sarah@headheartbiztherapy.com. Now I know you're thinking, what are the giveaways already? Well, very exciting. You will be entered into a drawing to win 1 hour sessions with both Anne and me. Anne will give you a choice between a private yoga class or a travel consultation session. And with me, you can choose between a 1 hour business coaching session or a Reiki session. Submissions must be received by 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on April 24th. The winner will be announced on social media on May 1st, and Anne and myself will reach out to you to schedule your sessions. So please enjoy our anniversary giveaway and celebrate our little Anne Remy.
How do you feel about the term healer as applied to what you're doing?
I like the word healer. I think I like the word healer. I think it's better than psychotherapist. I mean, because
<Fair enough. laughs>
it's kind of what we're doing, isn't it? I mean, it feels like. I don't know if, again, I guess this is the British stuff coming out, I guess. You know, am I the healer? I think I'm bringing a certain energy to people's experience, whatever that might be. And I think it's an experience of staying with, or being with, rather than, you know, trying to sort of like fix them or just letting them drift around on their own. I think that is healing in itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about how this, when you just said this idea of being with, what came to mind for me is, so I found your book very healing. A lot of it is partially, you know, it's speaking to a profession that I'm in, but as somebody who's not from the UK, living in the UK, your book said a lot of things that I see that nobody talks about. So for me, kind of having it written out in clear English was so validating of my experience of what goes on here. And that to me was healing. And it felt like, even though I've only just met you online today, it felt like you were with me in that moment when I was reading that book and going, oh my God, I'm so glad he said that. Like,
yeah.
So I really like this idea of healing as being with rather than doing to or.
Yeah. And doing to. And of course, you know, people expect you to do something. Give me a formula that's going to make this go away. So you are, you know, you're doing something as well, aren't you? So you can give people strategies to cope. I don't know if that would be healing as such, but I think there's another level in there. I think a sort of what's the word I'd use? A sort of, you know, things are still maybe pretty crap. Maybe things have got slightly better in your life. It's sort of contentment, I guess. That's the one. Sort of content with where you are now, knowing that it's going to be different tomorrow, it might be better tomorrow, but just kind of really, really inhabiting the place that you're actually in and really appreciating what that experience is like. I'm sort of moving into sort of Buddhism here, aren't I guess, but
I love it.
But I think there is a sort of flavor of that. I think when I'm doing work with people, that there's a sort of sense of, okay, these are the things going on in my life, and okay, it's okay. You know, it's all right. It's not going to be like this forever. I can do this, 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 and that, and hopefully that might change it. So I think there's something about this contentment of being, isn't there? Because I think when I was, you know, in the music thing, I wasn't really content. I think that's kind of really the overall feeling I had. I mean, I had loads of stuff. Objectively, it was great, but I just wasn't content. And then obviously then I've been doing some work around how to bring that contentment. And I think that contentment basically is around connection, isn't it? With other people.
Well, and with what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Not having a massive goal or even having a small goal that you reach and then they think, well, what am I going to do now? You know, like a job or whatever, like that kind of thing. But there's something about the process of just living and, you know, that being a goal in itself.
Yeah.
Sorry, getting deep.
No, I love this. So I recently interviewed a friend of mine who works with a foundation that supports bringing Muslim voices into the media and into the world. And one of the things that she and I were talking about is the stories that we want people to be able to tell are Muslim people just like living their lives. You know, it doesn't have to be about trauma or, you know, all the worst things. It can just be about us living our lives, and that's fine too. Like, I want to see Muslims in science fiction. I want, you know, not everything has to come back to the most painful bits. And that's really what I heard you say is like, yeah, just living life can be enough and can be great. And the contentment in that, I think, is so important in some ways as an act of rebellion.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. But, you know, there's lots of forces, aren't there, at work that kind of say we need to be doing whatever we need to be doing. We need to be bold. We need to be, you know, on this goal. We need, you know, there's a lot that's kind of countering that just being feeling, because you need to be more than you are, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm wondering how you balance contentment with continuing the work that you're doing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I've often thought about that question because it's a lot of work and it's been going on for a very long time. And where's the energy come from? And in a way, I don't really have like a destination as such. Obviously, I want to improve conditions in training courses and in therapy in general so that people with minoritized experiences can also get their money's worth out of training and counseling. But I guess what sort of keeps me going is, I guess it's sort of other people's kind of excitement about projects that they're working on or things that they're doing. You know, listening to you just before we did the podcast, talking about your experience of, you know, going through a kind of an experience of training and just sort of listening to those stories and, yeah, getting the sense that, oh, right, actually the things that I've done are kind of giving, you know, a little bit of wind on your sail, in your sails.
Hell yeah.
I mean, there's probably, you know, wind from all over the place, but I've contributed to that, you know, and I think that sort of keeps me going, really, I think.
Yeah, you've given me quite a lot of wind in my sails, to be honest. I'm not going to downplay it.
Okay, okay. All right, okay.
Credit where credit is due, right? Because of you, it is more important for me to be doing my own work. And it's easier for me to help other people do that same work. Like, you've opened so many doors, and I know, you know, some of my classmates, your organization is so supportive of, and, you know, through their richer experiences, my experience is richer, right? Like, I'm benefiting all over the place from the work you do. And I'm curious now how you feel about the term wounded healer as applied to the work you do.
I think it's through my wounds that has kind of spurned me on, really, isn't it? Spurned me on to look at myself more deeply, sort of challenge myself, my tendency to dismiss myself and all of that stuff that comes with that kind of attitude. So, yeah, I mean, I think attending to your wounds is an essential part, isn't it, of healing. I'm questioning about whether it's essential, but certainly for me, it does feel like quite a big part of it, really. Because if you're working with other human beings, and you know you're working with your own wounds, it makes sense to me. I can't sort of definitively say this, but it does make sense to me that you're kind of better placed, aren't you, to be with someone else in their pain and their difficulty and their kind of struggles. You're attending to them in a way of, through experience, sort of direct experience, rather than through sort of some sort of teaching method.
Mm.
Methods are great. You know, don't have anything wrong with methods and what that kind of, you know, sort of strategies for people. I kind of resonate with that wounded healer idea as well. Yeah, I think it's important to kind of know that actually, you know, as a healer, you're coming from your wounds, I guess, to some degree, especially in the this kind of psychological space.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's necessary to know about your wounds, but it's a fringe benefit to heal them.
Mm. Mm.
And that, I think, is a gift that we give each other through community, through therapy, through whatever, really, through connections with others.
I mean, with my book, which sort of focuses on racial identity and how that impacts people and people's conditioning, I think one of the challenges in order to end racism, of course, there's the structural capitalism structure, which is kind of pushing it back into play. Mm. So, you know, we can't forget that about that. But if we ignore that for now,
no problem.
No problem. We could just ignore that, get it out of the way. There's still work to be done. And I think one of the challenges really for this work is the idea of whiteness or white identity being investigated for people, or them investigating it. Because it's easy to see race, you know, across the street, over the tracks, over there.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a big challenge. And my book is kind of, I guess, challenging people to look at that. And also to look at whiteness in themselves. You know, if you're a person of color, if you're a black person, there's also a sort of, you know, I see it anyway, construct in that whiteness, which kind of lives in people.
Yeah.
It's obviously going to be more likely to live in white bodies, but, you know, it lives wherever it lives. And to investigate that part of the dynamic of race, you know, is a desperate need at the moment.
And I think it's not a challenge that's issued to us, and by us I mean white therapists, enough. I was halfway through my training, and it was Aisha who said, "What's your relationship with your whiteness?" And I went, No one's ever asked me that before. And as soon as she said it, my black friends have a relationship with their blackness because they necessarily have to, right? My Asian friends have a relationship with their Asianness because they necessarily have to, or they have to have explored it. We will all have a relationship with our race and with whiteness. But I think white people are not challenged to explore that. And it is not fun or easy work, but it is so important. And I'm not even going to pretend like I'm on the other side of it. It's an ongoing process.
Yes.
But I can speak to how liberating the process is. And that's something else that your book helped me with, was kind of find my way along that process.
Well, it's great to hear that. I mean, I often ask the same question of some of my white colleagues. And in a way, you kind of, for some, it sort of changes the relationship, not in a good way.
Mm.
So there's a risk, isn't there? I think for people of color to sort of challenge white people, because then if the relationship changes, you know who's going to get the sort of sharp end of the stick, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I kind of still do that in kind of maybe not direct ways. With some people, it's more direct, but with others, it's perhaps more kind of progressive over time. Sort of throwing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and then maybe move into the kill somewhere down the road.
But even that,
it's not a kill. So even that phrasing, you know, it's kind of, you know what I mean? It's kind of got that. It shouldn't be that way, but that's kind of how it feels.
Yeah, but even that requires you to expend energy for someone else, and I think that you know it's so important to recognize that. And speaking of energy, I could go on and on about this, but I do want to be respectful of your time. Can you tell us where we can find you on the internet, where we can find your book?
Yeah, we have a website, the Black African and Asian Therapy Network. We call ourselves Barton, or if we're up in north of England, it's Batten.
I would say Batten.
Batten, yeah. Yeah,
that's the American way.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And it's www.batn.org.uk. So that's the website. Mm. And on the website, there is a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff. There's lots and lots of stuff. Lots of videos, podcasts. There's all kinds of stuff. So people can just access that for free. There's also a directory of therapists of color in the UK. I think they're mostly in the UK. So there's a, I think there must be coming up to 1,000 awesome. Therapists on that directory. And though it's been great to sort of hear people I don't know kind of saying, oh yeah, it's huge, it's you. Wow. I got a therapist from your directory.
Sweet.
You know, that happens all the time now. And it's really, yeah, it's really good. And then my book is The Race Conversation. Get it from Amazon. But it's also going to come out on Norton Professional Books, maybe June, July, sort of revamped and Americanized.
Woohoo!
Version. Oh!
Hey! Lots of Zs.
Oh, yeah, Zs there you go. Dropped a lot of Us, added a lot of Zs.
Yeah. Sorry, Zs, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, people can contact me. I'm on the website, really, mainly. I also have there's a sort of separate page just for me, if you want to contact me directly. So it's just eugeneellis.co.uk, the website.
Thank you. And we'll have all the links to that in the show notes so anyone can find all those resources easily available. Eugene, thank you so much for everything, for all of the references and all of my papers and for coming on today. I really enjoyed this conversation and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Anne. Real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guest for an amazing conversation today. To find out more about today's guest, you can visit www.headheartbiztherapy.com/podcast.
You can find Sarah at Head Heart Biz Therapy on Facebook and Instagram.
And you can find Anne at Spare Room Wellness or spareroomwellness.com.
Thanks as always to Andrea Klunder and the Creative Imposter Studios for editing, to Liam O'Donnell for the album art, and to Ben Mueller for our theme music. Until next time, bye-bye.